our success was anything but instant. It was a total grind with, you know, 100 more failures and no's than successes and yeses.
Right,
but
right.
You just got to have the grit
right.
and keep going.
Wow. Wow. Hi, I'm Eric Weir, and welcome to another episode of Stuttering Your Way to Success. Today, I have a special guest, a friend of mine named John Warren. He wrote a book. This is an excellent read, and it talks about he built a business from scratch, sold it for over $1 billion. He was a Marine. He made a run at governor, and despite ever being in politics, he got really, really, really close. So congratulations. And I just wanted to talk to John. I want to learn from him, learn how he grows a business, learn how he thinks, and have advice for us. And one thing I can appreciate is I was talking to him earlier. This is a picture of my grandfather. He was in the Marine Corps. And he was at Iwo Jima. He was in the 5th Division Marine. And what he said is everyone, Eric, who's a Marine, has a story as to why they're a Marine. So I wanted to understand, hear from you, why did you go in the Marine Corps, and how did that impact your life?
Well, it was a great opportunity to go in. I mean, I really wanted to go in, but the main thing that was the catalyst for that was 9/11.
Okay.
I had actually been recruited for basketball by all the academies prior to 9/11 in 97, 98, and I told them all no.
Wow.
And then 2001 happened, September 11th, and I just felt really called to go in and serve like my grandfathers did in World War II.
That's fantastic. How did the Marine Corps, how did it shape you? Because when I read your book, you have a lot of back and forth the Marine Corps, but I mean, for our listeners, I mean, you're in, what's it like to go through boot camp? What's it like to come out? You're an officer, and then, wow, you're in combat, right? So I mean, walk me through that.
I mean, the Marine Corps, I tell everyone, the Marine Corps is going to bring out your greatest traits. It's also going to bring out your worst traits. It's going to test you in ways that you can't think are physically or mentally possible, and it's just a huge challenge. So I went in 2005, went through about a year of training, and the one thing that the Marine Corps, you know, really, really stresses more than anything are the core values, honor, okay. courage, and commitment.
Okay.
And that's one of the themes that we talk about in the book, Lead Like a Marine, mm-hmm. is any organization, family unit, whatever it is, even an individual, I think it really comes down to the most important thing is core values.
That's fantastic. Walk me through what was it like? I mean, you're a Marine. You go through college. You go through boot camp. You're prepared, and next thing you know, you're leading people. And not like, hey, I'm a manager at Starbucks, you know, or I'm a manager at a retailer, or I own an investment advisory practice. I mean, what's it like? I mean, people like live and die based on what you do. So, how do you prepare for that?
Well, I think first of all, it was hard to get in,
right.
and. You know, I tried to get in, 9/11 happened, and then there was this backlog of people trying to get into the Marine Corps. I was told I was going to have to wait a year, and then about a month later, I was called, and they said, hey, we got a slot for you. All you have to do is pass the physical fitness test.
Okay.
And one of the requirements was pull-ups, and I failed the minimum pull-ups.
Oh, wow.
So I was distraught at that point. I got rejected, and then I spent the next 1 year training to try to be a Marine, and then ultimately got in.
Wow.
Then went through a year of training. We wanted to go to Afghanistan or Iraq, mm-hmm. wanted to lead Marines in combat. Mm-hmm. And I remember leaving the wire in Ramadi, Iraq for the first time, mm-hmm. thinking, what on earth am I doing here? It was just kind of a surreal experience.
Sure, sure.
But we were focused on the mission. We were fighting a counterinsurgency in Ramadi, mm-hmm. which was the Sunni capital of the world. It was very intense combat. We lost 18 Marines in the battalion. My platoon earned about 1/3 Purple Hearts.
Wow.
So it was an intense combat experience, but I go back to core values, the bonds we had with fellow Marines. Mm-hmm. I would do anything for those guys and vice versa. So overall, it's an odd phrase that I'm about to say, but I wouldn't trade that time period for any other time period in my life.
Wow, that's fantastic. I mean, I've heard that a lot. My grandfather was a Marine, and he had bonds with those men, and going through battle, he didn't share with anyone else on the planet, really. And they would talk for 50 years after the war. They talk every Christmas, and they'd stay in touch. And to hear him talk about and he didn't talk about it much, right? Very little. And that generation didn't talk about a lot anyway. But when he did, it was always a fondness and just super deep respect. So today, you kind of walk me through. You're in the Marine Corps. You learned values. You learned the three, you know, honor, courage, and commitment. And then you leave the Marine Corps. And one of the things you mentioned in your book is a lot of people sometimes when they leave the military, it's different. It's a transition period. What's that like for you to transition from an active duty in the Marine Corps to you come back and you're a civilian?
I think that's the biggest challenge. You know, I faced what a lot of veterans face when we leave the service, which is I think people truly value and appreciate what we did in the Marine Corps, mm-hmm. but they don't necessarily value or understand the skill sets that you learned and how it can really transform into the civilian world. So a lot of people said, thank you for your service, but you don't have any industry experience. That's what I heard over and over again. So ultimately, I couldn't really get a job. I was discouraged. Mm-hmm. I had just gotten married, wanted to be able to provide for our family. Sure. Courtney, I tell everyone Courtney was our first angel investor because she had the only income coming into the family. And that really enabled me to start sure. a company. And
right.
you know, a lot of people say, hey, it was a huge risk to start a company. I didn't think it was a risk because I didn't have any other opportunities.
Right.
I didn't have any money to lose.
Right.
So really the only thing I was investing was time and effort and took a chance, started a real estate finance company that did loans to real estate investors and really grew it from there. And, you know, my second hire was my company gunnery sergeant from Iraq.
Top.
Was John Thompson. We call him Top.
Yeah.
He was in 22 years. He did 9 deployments, 5 combat deployments.
Wow.
He was the most respected senior enlisted person in the company. And there's no one that is better at running a company as COO than a senior enlisted, you know, gunnery sergeant, master sergeant from the Marine Corps.
I've heard that from other people. It's good that you validate that too. So as I read through your book, you mentioned, you know, that Courtney was working. Was it catering she was doing, or what was she doing? What kind of business did she have?
Courtney was in insurance. She was a commercial insurance broker, so
right.
E&O, D&O.
Okay.
Stuff of that
okay,
nature.
She was in insurance, and so you had no capital. You started your business with nothing. You're the first guy. And how much do you know about real estate finance at the time?
Zero. The only experience I had in real estate was I'd flipped a couple homes with my brother when the market was hot, going
okay.
back to 2003, 2004
okay.
for additional income. So I kind of knew the flip market a little bit.
Okay.
But that was also a time period where if you bought a house, you could immediately turn around and sell it for more than you bought it because
okay.
the market was on fire.
Okay.
But I knew the market. I liked it.
Right.
And I saw an opportunity to get into financing because it was right after the financial crisis,
mm-hmm.
and banks had kind of been prevented at that point from lending to real estate investors, no matter how credit worthy they were.
Okay.
So I saw an opportunity and then just went, you know, door to door to high net worth individuals trying to raise capital, telling them I would give them a 9 to 11% return.
Okay.
And I mean, we say this in the book, our success was anything but instant. It was a total grind with, you know, 100 more failures and no's than successes and yeses.
Right.
But
right.
you just got to have the grit
right.
and keep going.
Wow. So how did you underwrite loans? I mean, you don't know anything about it. I mean, you know, I think I read in your book, you know, like anyone can make a loan, right? It was a kid or somebody told
yeah.
you, like, my kid can make a loan, right? Getting paid back and monitoring is different. I mean, I can't even imagine. I mean, how'd you set that up? Because how many loans were you doing even when you started? It was like a lot, right?
Yeah, I mean, we raised, my first investor gave $1 million.
Okay.
And what we did was we did 9 loans with that $1 million.
Okay.
And we called it a seed fund because that was a great form of marketing, right? It sounds
okay.
a lot better than I only got $1 million.
Right.
So we said,
right.
hey, it's a seed fund, right?
Right.
But we came up with the lending standards mainly because of common sense.
Okay.
And that's one of the principles we discuss in the book is
right.
called do everything for a reason.
Okay.
And we found that a lot of the banks, for a variety of reasons, don't do everything for a reason. So we came up with common sense
mm-hmm.
lending standards
mm-hmm.
and went from there. And even today, Lima One has less than a 1% foreclosure rate and is profitable on taking back the properties due to the lending standards that we came
wow.
up with.
Wow. So how long is your underwriting process? And if you're listening to this and you know, I know how long it is for banks. It's a long time. You try to buy a house, it could be 60 days, right? So how long is your underwriting
process? We prided ourselves on we would close a loan within 10 days of application.
Wow.
And that included a lot of construction, you know, financing with that. So that was our pitch to our clients. Hey, come here. You're going to be honest, straightforward. We prided ourselves on no junk fees. It sounds simple, but I mean, have you looked at a HUD recently from all the junk fees that you get charged from the banks?
Right.
So we said no junk fees. We'll close within 10 days. And that was that's how we made it.
And what would you charge the end user?
Well, I mean, it varied. You know, right now, I think Lima One is probably at 7% rate, which is super low.
Right.
You know, I think we started charging 3% origination fee and 15% interest when we started.
Right.
Our cost of capital was 11%. So we had to get something above that.
And how long are the loans? They're not that long.
Well, back then it was 13 months.
Okay.
Because that gave the individual time to buy the property, rehab it, and then sell it.
Okay.
And then we later got into rental loans, which went to 30 years. We got into securitization. I think now, you know, Lima One's originated over $5 billion or more.
Congratulations. It's humming. Fantastic. So that's amazing.
It was a great ride.
So were there times where you're like, you have demand? Because with any business, how do you match demand, right? Where you're like, your marketing efforts maybe are better than your capital raising efforts, or your capital efforts are better than your marketing efforts. So how did you balance? Were there ever times you had like more demand than you had available capital, or you saw like this is going to be a problem soon? Or
early on, we prided ourselves on if you're going to be a lender, you have to have credibility, which meant you have to have capital. Mm-hmm. So we never tried to advertise unless we had capital.
Okay.
And initially, you know, we did the $1 million. We had a track record of success. And then we raised more capital, and we were only lending in South Carolina and Georgia.
Okay.
And then from there, we started growing. We brought in more institutional investors. We brought on large banks. And then almost overnight, we talk about a story in the book where we raised a lot of capital based on a hedge fund in New York, and the challenge kind of flipped at that point.
Okay.
When you get the institutional capital, all they want is more and more capital going out the door.
Right.
So it became a challenge of scaling really quickly and maintaining the same quality of loans. Okay.
So if someone's listening to this now and they're an entrepreneur and like, man, I want to start a business, and maybe it's not what you do, but what advice would you give them? Because you started with no capital, really no experience. I want to start a business. What should I do to get the clarity, and what steps should I consider taking?
I think the biggest thing that set us up for success, I would say it's three things. One, we always did what we said we were going to do. And if we couldn't do it for some reason, we were just upfront. And that will separate you from almost everyone in business, because I think business, you have a lot of people who are constantly lying to people. The second thing is, you got to have a record of success, a track record. And for us, it was all about originating quality loans that no one can argue about. So if you're a carpenter, hey, build the best cabinets that you possibly can. If you're a widget maker, have the best, have a track record of success. And then for us, you know, it was really important to get large. And for us, that meant having a scalable model. And we came up with an origination process to where if we originate a loan in Seattle, it's the exact same as we originate a loan in Greenville, South Carolina.
Okay.
It's the same process, and it just brings uniformity, and it really helps with processes.
Yeah, this is super. One of the concepts of our show, Studying Away Success, is there's really no success without setback that I've been ever aware of. Could you share with us maybe a setback you experienced, and then what you learned from that?
Well, I mean, I think the story of Lima One is just failure, 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 and then get a little bit of success. And I call it kind of the stepladder approach. You know, you grow, you get better, and then you plateau. And the key to growth is getting through the plateaus or the failures faster than all the others. So, I mean, you know, it was hard to raise the capital initially. I remember I would go meet with all these individuals. One of the funny stories I had was someone from my Bible study told me, hey, I've got 316,000 $400 and 52 cents I want to invest with you. I mean, like, that's a very detailed figure, right?
Yeah, it's precise, yeah.
And he goes, I just want to run it by my wife. I said, great. And he lived in an unbelievable country club of the South neighborhood in Atlanta. He had all Mercedes, had a second home. And we get there, and we sit down at the table, and his wife's right there. And the second slide for legal purposes was you had to be an accredited investor. And I just kind of skipped over that because clearly they were accredited investors. And the wife said, wait, go back. And I said, man, that's just accredited investors. Clearly you're one. And she starts reading it and she goes, Dave, this isn't you. You're not an accredited investor. She's like, you've been laid off from work for 4 years. He told me he was retired.
Oh,
she's like,
wow.
I mean, they're about to take our second house. You're down to $300,000, blah, 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 in your 401k, and you want to give it all to this guy?
No way.
And I'm just thinking, oh, this is a total disaster.
Right.
The guy's now embarrassed.
Right.
And they're going back and forth. And I just remember slowly closing the laptop and saying, clearly you guys aren't on the same page. If you would like to do something in the future, let me know. I got back in my car. Got stuck in Atlanta traffic, and for an hour and a half, I was just fuming and very, very devastated from not getting the investment that ultimately I thought I had already raised. So
That's one of the funny stories. Well, so if you could go back and talk to your 20-year-old self and give your 20-year-old self advice, what would you say?
I think the benefit of being a 20-year-old is you don't understand how hard it's going to be. It's harder, and I think that's one of the reasons why you don't see a ton of entrepreneurs for the first time being in their 50s, 60s. Like, it's hard, and you've got kids, and you've got responsibilities, and you've got mortgage payments, and it's really hard to try to start a company at that age if you really need your salary.
Right.
So as a 20-year-old, you know, you're young, you're naive, you're optimistic. And I think there's a lot of positives for that. So I think we clearly made a ton of mistakes. We didn't have experience in the industry, but I think we made up for it with grit.
That sounds like it. So in your book, you talked about you started following the traditional business advice, but there was something along the way that you ran into. It's like, I'm going to follow my gut more or intuition and be, you know, kind of my eyes wide open. What was that event?
One of the stories we tell in the book, I think it's the actual opening, we had gotten an investment banker to have us have a meeting with William Irby. William Irby at the time was a multi-billionaire, and he was looking for mortgage companies to invest in. So we fly down to Miami. We have these grand ambitions to be a billion-dollar originator within 5 years. And right before we go into the meeting, the investment banker looks at me and says, do not tell William Irby that you're going to be a billion-dollar company.
Wow.
And I said, well, why not? I've got this great business plan.
Yeah.
And he said, that's going to seem naive. You're going to seem ignorant. And he's not going to want to invest in someone like that.
Wow.
So at that point, I said, you know what? This investment banker, he's the expert. I'm going to rely on him. And we get into the meeting, and Irby has actually read our investment deck. He's asking us thoughtful questions. We think the answers are going really well. We have a rapport with him. And right then, I know we're going to close William Irby. This is going to set us up for unlimited success.
Sure.
We're going to be able to go from lending in 3 states to 18 overnight. And he said, one last question, John. How big can you be? And I look at the investment banker, and he shakes his head, and he means, don't do it. Don't throw out the billion-dollar number.
No way.
And I'm thinking really quickly, what do I do? And then I throw out, we can be a $500 million originator in 5 years. And William Irby closes our investor deck, and he said, John, I really appreciate you coming down here, but if you can't be a billion-dollar company in 5 years, I just don't have time for you.
Oh,
and
come on.
That was just a huge gut punch. But, you know, we learned our lesson from there on out. We went with our instincts. We went with, you know, common sense, critical thinking, and that sets you apart in the business world, I think.
Wow. So what motivates you today?
Today I'm motivated by a lot of things. I really want to give back to the community. I want to help people. I think hard work, individual responsibility, that's an unbelievable opportunity to give someone if they can be successful in business, they can provide for their family. I really respect people that work hard and are honest. And sometimes the system's just against them, right? And I think it's really hard right now for the middle class to make it in this world. Inflation's super high. You know, costs of mortgages are going up. Home prices are going up. I really want to help the middle class because I think the system is almost rigged against them.
Wow. Okay, I'm going to turn the clock back a few years. I remember meeting you, I guess maybe 2012 or 13 at a fundraiser event. I think it was at Thornblade or somebody's house. And and then later, out of nowhere, I'm like, you're running for governor. Not like I take another position. I started in the warm-up. You go straight for governor. And you just about made it. So, I mean, why did you run? And have you ever thought about maybe trying it again?
Well, I think we have a deficit of leadership at all levels. I think, you know, being in South Carolina, we're a conservative state, but the legislature doesn't act like it. And we don't have real leadership in South Carolina right now. And in 2018, it was the same situation. And I wasn't planning on running, but I just got really frustrated with ultimately how everyone was padding their pockets down in Columbia at the expense of the middle class. And I thought I could do better. And I got into the race late. I got in February for the Republican primary. Everyone said we had no shot. We made the runoff. And then we were up 13 points with a week to go. And then that's when President Trump came down and endorsed Henry McMaster to repay a favor and lost by 3 points in the end. But it was a tough loss. But we ran a positive campaign, brought up a lot of issues. And, yeah, I mean, I definitely care about South Carolina and think we need good leadership.
Sure. So what are you doing now? I mean, you sold Lima One. It was a nice exit. And I remember the scuttlebutt is he'll back into real estate. He'll do something like that. But you didn't do that. So you went into something different. I mean, what are you doing now?
Primary role is trying to keep pace with my 7.5, 5.5, and 4-year-olds.
Oh, wow.
So they're at amazing ages, and I'm able to spend more time with them. But, you know, I got into Bitcoin mining, and everyone said, hey, that's a totally different industry. Why aren't you in real estate? And for me, that mortgage, you know, at Lima One that we originated, the reason we were able to attract capital was because it threw off a yield, an interest rate for investors. And that's how I look at these Bitcoin miners.
Okay, interesting.
You know, I look at a Bitcoin miner as kind of like a mortgage. It mines every day. It mines a little bit of Bitcoin. And ultimately, it just comes in a different form. It's different currency. It's, you know, crypto. It's BTC. And I was able to attract the same institutional investors that backed me at Lima One to back me at Gem Mining.
Okay.
So we're a very large private right now, private company that does Bitcoin mining with about 30,000 miners.
Wow. So what's a miner, for those of us who don't know?
So a miner, a lot of people, you know, one of my buddies famously asked me in front of some other buddies, which he still gets teased about, how did you hire so many miners so quickly, and where are the mines? And he's still living that down now.
I bet.
You know, a miner is just a computer that is designed specifically to solve a complex algorithm.
Right.
And when you solve that complex algorithm, you get a Bitcoin. That's a very simplistic way to look at it.
How is the speed of processing in AI, how will that influence the mining industry?
Right now, I'm not sure how AI will see the impact of AI, but it's really about the computing processing power. So chips have definitely gotten smaller and smaller and smaller and more efficient. I think you're going to get to a point where you're not getting the huge incremental increases in efficiency. So I think right now you're kind of stalled, and we'll see where the technology goes. A lot of it also involves, you know, how cheap can you get the electricity?
Correct. Yeah.
And that's one of the things that people are focused on, and where can you be where it doesn't overheat?
Yeah, the heat's a big deal too. Right?
And then another thing is liquid immersion. So putting the machines in what's really mineral oil to have them run harder and faster without overheating.
Right.
And they call that overclocking.
Correct.
So, you know, I think all of those things will really detail how you're going to
What's the life of a machine?
Well, if you buy an efficient miner, you know, the most efficient miner is like a Bitmain XP or a Bitmain S19J Pro. Mm-hmm. Those things can last. A lot of it involves how much is Bitcoin valued. Mm-hmm. But for us right now, that will remain efficient as long as BTC is above 15,000.
Okay. All right. So does the value, I mean, obviously 15,000, you just said is a number. So if it's, you know, 15.5, 25, I think today it's down a little bit, 26 or so.
Yeah.
But, so do you watch it that closely or not that closely?
I mean, we watch it just to be curious.
Sure.
But I think we look at the larger trends.
Okay.
So I think long-term, as long as you're positioned to where your cost of capital and your electricity is so cheap, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not worried if it goes from 30 to 26. Mm-hmm. I'm worried if it goes from 30 to 15, because then you start getting into, are we going to be profitable day to day?
Sure.
But we also, you have to make it to where you've negotiated good contracts mm-hmm. to where you can turn the machine off if it's not profitable.
Correct.
So we've done that.
So some countries have made Bitmain illegal, right? They just stopped it. I mean, how does that impact? Is there any regulatory risk of that happening in other places?
I don't think that's going to happen here. There are too many institutional clients who have institutional capital partners who mm-hmm. have invested in this. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of countries don't like BTC because they want to be able to control their own currency. Mm-hmm. They don't want a rival currency, right? And mm-hmm. BTC is really for the people. Mm-hmm. And they can't manipulate it. There's only 21 million that's ever going to be produced.
Right.
Whereas the American dollar, even the US dollar, hey, they can just print it. They can devalue it.
Right.
The government controls it. The mm-hmm. Fed controls it. Mm-hmm. But with BTC, it's finite. Mm-hmm. And that makes me a little more comfortable.
Is there an algorithm where it takes more energy or more complex problem solving as there are fewer and fewer remaining? And what's the estimated, when is the 21st million coin created?
So that's probably 100 years out. What happens, every 4 years you have what's called halving events.
Okay.
To where when you mine, mm-hmm. you're getting half what you used to get the previous 4 years.
Okay.
So the next halving event is May of 2024.
Oh, wow.
And then the one after that is going to be 28.
Okay.
And each time you get half of the mining of BTC that you used to. So that spaces it out. So I think the last of the BTC will be mined in about 100 years.
How does it impact the price? I mean, I would think that would be that would cause some upward pressure on the
traditionally,
right.
Bitcoin values go through the roof mm-hmm. after the halving.
Okay.
But, you know, nothing certain.
Right.
And I tell everyone, if you want to look at an industry that looks kind of like an EKG of your heart rate, that is the value of BTC. So it's a little, it's much more stressful.
Right.
I didn't have that in the mortgage world, but it also makes it a little more exciting.
Yeah, I'm sure. What's next? I mean, you've now have founded two huge companies in a relatively short period of time. So I mean, what's on the horizon for you next?
Well, I mean, we spent a lot of time writing the book, mm-hmm. and I think the book offers people a real concrete path to good leadership. Mm-hmm. So we've been doing that, launched, HarperCollins published that July 11th. So we've been doing a lot of podcasts, a lot of TV interviews,
radio. It
was
a best-selling book, too, by the way.
It was a bestseller. So the running joke is we're already working on the sequel. I'm sure people are shocked that two Marines wrote a book.
Right.
But we said that the sequel is going to be Read Like a Marine, and it's going to be a coloring book.
There you go.
So I spent a lot of time on that,
spent
a lot of time on business, and definitely involved in politics still. So we'll see what happens in the future.
All right. But there's more to come, right?
Yeah, there's definitely more to come. Hopefully,
exactly.
If God lets me stick around for a little while
longer. Exactly. So if you were to say, I mean, we learned honor, courage, commitment, some of the things that when I was reading through the book, I saw that you hire unusual people. And I'm like, you know, you're not like necessarily going through, not that you don't use, you know, headhunters, or you may not hire people from different schools, but you have some unusual practices. Could you share one with us?
Sure. I mean, most people, I think, hire everyone based on industry experience, right?
Right.
Hey, if you need an underwriter, you're going to look for underwriters.
Right.
We're actually the opposite of that. We want to look for people that share our core values.
Mm-hmm.
And the traits that we found of successful leaders in any field are extreme hard work, honesty, grit. And when I say grit, life is hard, and I don't care how much money you have. Mm-hmm. I don't care what your situation is. Life is hard. Mm-hmm. And are you going to have the grit, the intestinal fortitude to keep coming back and trying to achieve when things that are bad happen?
So
that's one of them. So we look for all these traits, and then from there we look for core, what we call core competencies.
Okay.
We don't look for industry experience. I don't want an underwriter that used to work for a big bank because I think they've been trained wrong.
Right.
We look for core values and core competencies, and then we spend a lot of time training them.
Okay.
So, you know, in the book, we go through a lot of interesting people that we hired. We hired a Georgia football player who was just an amazing sales guy, but with no experience. But we knew he was going to be successful. He's now the highest paid employee at Lima One, probably still.
Wow.
We hired multiple bartenders. We hired veterans.
Yeah.
But we tell everyone, you know, the Marine Corps model is this exact same model.
Okay.
Because think about the Marine Corps or any military.
Right.
They're not going to hire anyone with combat experience because you can't get it outside of the Marine Corps. So they have to hire people based on core values.
Okay. There you go.
And then train them. Okay. And that's the way, that's what made us successful. And that's why we had, when I left, it was like 92% retention rate. And the ones that left,
congratulations,
usually were the ones we asked to leave.
Wow. Do you have a way, how do you align compensation and reward with effort?
Well, I mean, we want, in every regard, we want people to do better because they come to Lima One. Mm-hmm. We want them to share in the company's success. And I think you have to do that from the top down, right? When I started the company, I had 100% ownership. Ultimately, I gave away 25% of the company to my employees. When we when we sold, there were 7 millionaires created. And that's something that I think is really important to share in equity.
Right.
So, you know, with salespeople, we never cap a salesperson. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, go originate and make as much money as you possibly can, and that's going to help the company. So we never limited someone's success, but we also rewarded for performance. You know, for our underwriters, do the loans perform?
Right.
Because, you know, you said it earlier, we had a quote in the book from an investor, anyone can make a loan.
Right.
My 7-year-old can make a loan.
Right.
Can it perform and you get the money back?
Right.
So you have to really make sure that your compensation is aligned to performance,
right,
not necessarily revenue and originations.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. Okay, last question, or maybe one of the last questions. Imagine I'm listening to this and I'm in a job and I'm just not happy with the job that I'm in and I want to do something. I mean, any advice for somebody who says, I want to own my own business, you know, I'm frustrated. Maybe like your situation, maybe a spouse has a stable income. Any advice to them?
I think the greatest entrepreneurs, they see the world differently from other people.
Okay.
And I think entrepreneurs, what ultimately makes them successful, they see complex problems and they come up with simple solutions to solve them. Okay. I mean, think about Steve Jobs. Hey, there's this problem with phone. There's a problem with internet. There's a problem with, you know, all these different aspects. So what does he envision? He envisions an iPhone.
Right.
And I tell everyone, hey, if you want to be a billionaire, find a complex problem and come up with the most simplistic solution and that and build a company around it. So I think for someone really wanting to be an entrepreneur, what's something in society, preferably in your field where you have expertise in?
Sure. Right.
But what is something that you can do better? And will people pay for it?
Oh,
and what's a service or a product that you can build and solve that problem?
Wow.
Solve problems, make money.
Right. That's it. And then when you said you heard no lots of times, you went to go raise capital, you would call people, you set up meetings. You know, I look at that as grit. You mentioned grit. You find that. Is that something internal? Did you learn that, or is it just out of necessity? I got to do this, or bad things happen.
I think it's all of the above. Okay. I mean, I think we're the people we are because of life experiences, because God created us certain ways, because our parents might have had those traits. I mean, my dad worked so hard, and I wanted to be just like my dad, so I inherently wanted to work hard to be like him. So I think you pick up all these different things along the way. And I think in my own instance, you know, it's like, hey, I did it because my parents raised me to be that way. Right. I did it because God gave me grit.
Right.
I did it because I had to provide for my family. So it's kind of a combination of all of the above. So,
okay. How do you take time in a life that has demands from family, from business, political interests, activities, to get centered and to get clarity and direction? How do you as an individual take time to do that?
So we talk about this actually in the book. It gets to be where your life just becomes a rat race. Mm-hmm. And I don't care if you're a single mother of, you know, a five-year-old and a seven-year-old, your life is crazy. Mm-hmm. If you're a CEO of a big-time company, your life is crazy. So I think life is, I just go back to, life is hard, it's difficult.
Right.
And ultimately, all these external factors start impacting us. Mm-hmm. So what I did, you know, in the book, we called it morning ops.
Right.
Okay. And what I did, it was hard because I'm a natural night owl.
Okay.
But I started waking up at 3:45 to 4 in the morning when no one was sending me emails, no one was sending me text messages, and I could just focus on strategic things. Mm-hmm. And from 4 to 7:30, I just worked on strategy. Mm-hmm. Anything that I wanted to accomplish.
That's great.
And no one bothered me. It was quiet. I did prayer. I did Bible study during that time. And then I did anything strategic for the company. And then I went and worked out. I think physical fitness is really important. Mm-hmm. And after that, I was back in the office by 9:30 or 10 for a full day of what I would call normal work and reaction. But I think regardless of, you know, whether you do morning ops, you know, I would at least encourage people to block off 30 minutes here or an hour there just to do strategic planning and quiet time and really think about what you want out of your life, how to improve the company. And that to me is more offensive minded as opposed to reactionary.
Fantastic. That's solid. So good. Well, thank you for being my guest today.
Thanks for having me.
And this book is Lead Like a Marine by Captain John Warren and Master Sergeant John Thompson, also known as Top. I've been working my way through the book. It's fantastic. There's simple things you can apply. You can read it, and I guarantee you will learn something the first 5 or 10 pages. Great. Thanks for being on the show today.
Good having you. Thanks for having me.